Our passage this evening comes from 2 Samuel 10. 2 Samuel 10. And we will read the whole chapter, but we won't be dealing too much with the very last part of it since we dealt with some of those themes in connection with 2 Samuel 8 a while ago. 2 Samuel chapter 10, beginning at verse 1. Afterwards, the king of the sons of Ammon died, and Hanun his son became king in his place. And David said, I will deal kindly with Hanun, son of Nahash, as his father dealt kindly with me. So through his servants, David sent to comfort him about his father. So David's servants entered the land of the sons of Ammon. Now the princes of the sons of Ammon said to Hanun, their master, do you really think David is honoring your father because he has sent comforters to you? Isn't it to search the city and to spy it out and to overthrow it that David has sent his servants to you? So Hanun took hold of David's servants and shaved off half their beards and cut off their garments in the middle all the way up to the buttocks and sent them off. And some told David, and he sent to meet them, for the men were very humiliated. And the king said, stay in Jericho until your beards grow back and you can return. Now the sons of Ammon saw that they had stunk themselves up with David. So the sons of Ammon sent and hired Aram of Beth Rehob and Aram Zobah, 20,000 foot soldiers, plus the king of Maacah with 1,000 men and the men of Tob, 12,000 men. And David heard and sent Joab off and all the army of warriors. And the sons of Ammon came out and set up the battle at the opening of the gate. But Aram Zobah and Rehob and the men of Tob and Maacah were off by themselves in the open country. And Joab saw that the battle faced him in front and behind. So he selected from all the elite warriors in Israel and set them up to meet Aram. But the rest of the troops he placed under the leadership of Abishai, his brother, and he prepared them to meet the sons of Ammon. And he said, if Aram is too strong for me, you must help me. And if the sons of Ammon are too strong for you, I shall come to help you. Be strong, and let us fortify ourselves for our people and for the cities of our God, and Yahweh will do what he thinks right. Then Joab drew near for battle against Aram along with the troops who were with him, and they fled from him. And the sons of Ammon saw that Aram had fled, so they fled from Abishai and entered the city. Then Joab returned from the sons of Ammon and came to Jerusalem. Now Aram saw that they had been struck down before Israel, so they gathered themselves together and Hadadezer sent and brought out Arameans from beyond the river. And they came to Halam, with Shobach, captain of Hadadezer's force, leading them. And it was told David. So he gathered all Israel, crossed the Jordan, and came to Halam. And Aram prepared to meet David and fought with him. And Aram fled from Israel, and David killed from Aram 700 chariot troops and 40,000 horsemen, and he struck down Shobach, captain of his force, who died there. And when all the kings who were servants of Hadadezer saw they had been struck down before Israel, they made peace with Israel and served them. And Aram was afraid to ever again help the sons of Ammon. Well, sometimes it's hard to know what inferences to draw from things, especially written matters. Imagine a university student who falls sick, and this fellow was... Well, he had met a young lady, was in his class, and he talked with her, and maybe they were in the same campus group Bible study and so on, and then maybe they'd gone to a USC basketball game and had a Coke and a hamburger afterwards and so on, and she hears that he got sick and so on and has been out maybe with the flu or something, and so she sends him a note, not a text, but a note on her own personalized note card, and says she was sorry that she heard he was sick and she hoped he got better soon, etc., etc., and then at the end she said, thinking of you, comma, Kim. Now, that fellow may think about that thinking of you. As he sits there, he might think, well, now, I can understand. She doesn't sign it love. That would be over the top at this point. We don't know each other that well, etc. But thinking of you, now, does that mean just a kind of a passing thought, or that is a present participle, continuing action? Maybe she have me on her mind a lot. And so you see, it's hard to tell, to know what to infer. And it's the same way with biblical narratives, like an Old Testament narrative, like 2 Samuel 10. You have to tread carefully sometimes to try to sniff out the Holy Spirit's intention, and sometimes we wonder if we get it. Did we go too far or not far enough? Sometimes it's hard to know. That's one problem. And then, of course, another problem is that some passages in narratives are kind of themeless. They don't seem to have a driving, cohesive theme necessarily. And of course, in preaching, you're supposed to develop a theme and show the aspects of it and so on. Something like a passage like this doesn't seem to have a driving theme. Maybe how very honorable and kind intentions can lead to war or something like that. But it doesn't seem to be a cohesive theme. And so it's difficult when you're trying to develop it. How should you go about it? And sometimes you just have to drop back and punt and say, well, we've got the text anyway. There may be a few topics and themes, etc., several of them, and not necessarily a cohesive one, but can we find some inferences here that we can rightly draw from the text? And so that's kind of the way we sometimes come at it, like tonight. Just what are some of the inferences we might rightly draw from this passage, or maybe we go too far? We'll see. I think one thing, the first thing that we can see here is that covenant people rightly care about how they relate to outsiders. Covenant people rightly care about how they relate to outsiders. Verses 1 and 2. The king of the sons of Ammon died, and Hanan his son became king in his place. And David said, I will deal kindly with Hanan son of Nahash as his father dealt kindly with me. So through his servants, David sent to comfort him about his father, and so on. Now, it's the orientation details and the details of the text here. Several weeks back, we said, now, when you think of Ammon and the Ammonites, if you think of Columbia as Jerusalem, the Ammonites would be over Myrtle Beach way, except there's not the ocean for the Ammonites, and so on. But they're over east, the other side, the east of the Jordan River, and so on. And this fellow Nahash, we may have met him in 1 Samuel 11, or you may have in your reading. He was a king during Saul's time, if this is the same Nahash. And apparently, he had done David a good turn. We don't know exactly. When we get here, you know, he says, I will deal kindly with Hanan, son of Nahash, as his father dealt kindly with me. Now, that word deal kindly is really the same language as we had back in 2 Samuel 9 when it talked about Mephibosheth. And David wanted to deal kindly, or remember, show hesed, H-E-S-E-D, that commitment to a covenant in Mephibosheth's case. Now, was there a covenant here with Nahash? It could be that David, after he became king of Israel, had some sort of treaty with Nahash, and so that's why he's going to be faithful to his commitment, etc., and send condolences and so on. It may be a commitment to a treaty, or again, it may not. It may be not so much a showing hesed in being faithful to a covenant as it was with Mephibosheth in chapter 9. It may be more general idea of just dealing kindly, but the same language is used here. And so it may be that when David was running from Saul as an outlaw, that Nahash in some way had been gracious to David or something. Then David now wanted to respond in kind to Nahash's son on the death of his father. In any case, the depiction that you see here in 2 Samuel 9 at the beginning and then in chapter 10 at the beginning is that David is a hesed-showing king.
On the one hand, not only to Mephibosheth within the bounds of the covenant people, but even to somebody like Hanun, who was an outsider, who was a pagan, an Ammonite, beyond the bounds, you might say, of the people of God. Now, if that's perhaps meant to be a model, as trying to show David, and some of you are saying, well, yeah, but what about chapter 11? Wait. Don't go there yet. But in chapters 9 and 10, the writer here is trying to show you David as this Hesed-showing king, and he's dealing kindly in one aspect with people outside the bounds of the covenant people. Is that meant to be a model for the people of God? The New Testament certainly shoots us or pushes us in that direction as well, beyond our sometimes provincialism, doesn't it? You remember what, and it does this almost casually in a way. You remember what Galatians 6, verse 10 says, when Paul writes, "So then, as we have opportunity, let us do good to everyone, and especially to those who are of the household of faith." Christian believers have an obligation, particularly to other Christian believers, to care for them, but also to everyone, to those who are outside the bounds of the faith. And 1 Thessalonians 5:15, Paul says, "See that no one repays anyone evil for evil, but always seek to do good to one another and to everyone." So there's a certain concern, a certain care that the Lord's people have for those who are outside the people of God, and to deal kindly with them. The basis for that, of course, goes back to Matthew 5:45, where Jesus says that our Father makes his sun rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the just and the unjust. So it rains on the yard of the skeptical agnostic across the street and two doors down, just as it rains on your grass as well. God is so comprehensively merciful and compassionate that our care for those even outside the bounds of covenant faith ought to be similar. Now, sometimes when you think of applying this, faces us in our own family connections in a practical way, doesn't it? Because you may be an adult now, you may have your own family, depends where you are in life and so on. You may have parents who are not believers, and you may have siblings, and they may have families of their own, etc., and so on, but they're not believers. They don't share your faith. In fact, they may be kind of amused at you for your faith, or they may be kind of hostile and so on, a little edgy about it. Do you visit them? Do you socialize with them? Do you call them up occasionally and seek to catch up with them to show that where they are and what they're doing and what their problems might be matter to you? Or do you write them off? Do you stay aloof? Do you shut them out? Well, no, our desire should be to, as much as we can, to exercise courtesy and kindness and consideration toward them, even if they might be kind of edgy toward us, over time, acting in a Hesed way toward them may leave its mark. The covenant people rightly care about how they relate to outsiders. Now, secondly, the text may teach us the urgent need we always have for wisdom, verse 3 through the first part of verse 6. The urgent need we always have for wisdom. Now, this is one of those situations where you wonder how much do you infer from a narrative and so on. But the details of the story are pretty clear there in verses 3 to the first part of 6. The problem that Hanun had as he came to reign in Ammon was that he had a State Department, and sometimes that can be a problem. He had advisors who said to him, do you really think, Haman, that David is just conscientiously and graciously sending you his condolences through these ambassadors? Don't you know, Haman, that all ambassadors are spies? You're probably not far wrong there. But He sent these fellas, and they're casing out the place. They're trying to overthrow it. They're trying to check you out and get intelligence against you. And so Hanan, in verse 4, took hold of David's servants, shaved off half their beards, cut off their garments in the middle all the way up to the buttocks, and sent them off. A gross, nasty response. He could have just sent them home. He just said, leave, etc. He could have ejected them. But no, he had to do this, maybe on the basis of what his advisors told him. Grossly humiliating. To mess with a man's beard in that situation was to mess with his manhood. You can imagine if this was in another time that the a video of this, of these fellows leaving a Rabbah in Ammon through perhaps jeering crowds of Ammonites, that video would go viral on YouTube. This was a real nasty bit of rejection. And, of course, they understand what was involved. Verse 6, the sons of Ammon saw that they had stunk themselves up with David. That's a fairly literal translation. It is, however you put it, a kind of a smelly verb. And they realize we have really made a stink with David, and we're going to have to face it, as they would. Now, this is difficult now to know. That now, is the writer, by telling us this and reporting this, is he trying to teach us something? Is he wanting us to discern something here for ourselves? Or is he just reporting this, that this happened and so on? And this is where it gets hard. How much do you infer from a Bible narrative as to what's to be taught? You see, you get some people who charge you with moralizing if you try to draw lessons out of a narrative. And sometimes that's right. You go to 2 Kings chapter 6. Do you remember the story about the fellow who borrowed the axe? And while he was working with it, the axe head fell into the Jordan River and it was lost and so on. And some people would say, you see, you shouldn't borrow things from other people. Well, no, I don't think that's what that passage is teaching at all. I think that's moralizing and so on. But there are folks who say you shouldn't be drawing examples and so on and making too much of these situations. So they might say, don't make a whole lot about the stupidity of the Ammonites here in 2 Samuel 10, 3 and following. We have to ask ourselves, though, did the writer have a purpose other than merely reporting their wacko behavior? It's hard to tell. It's hard to sense the tone of a narrative as you're reading it because you only have the written record, and sometimes you can't sense whether there may be sarcasm there, for example. In many situations, of course, sarcasm is obvious for us, because we have more than just a written record. There was a time a few years ago when the journalist Andrew Ferguson was taking his family on a tour of some of the Abraham Lincoln sites in Kentucky, Indiana, Illinois, and they were in Springfield, Illinois, and he had a son and a daughter, and his wife was with them, and so on. They were making this Lincoln tour. And so they go, and here they are in a parking lot. And Ferguson says to his son and daughter, now this used to be the Globe Tavern. And here's where Abraham Lincoln and Mary Todd spent their wedding night. And their son Robert was born right here in this parking lot. Well, that kind of baffled them, you know. And then they go on in their tour, and he points out to them where Lincoln's law office used to be. Of course, it's not there now. It was torn down 100 years ago, but that's where it was, and where Joshua Speed's store was, where Lincoln lived when he first went to Springfield and so on. But it was torn down 100 years ago and so on. And well, it was about time for lunch. And then he said his daughter stopped suddenly, and she said, "Now, if I may have your attention," she patted a brick wall next to her. "You'll notice this fire escape here," she said. "Mr. Lincoln taught Springfield all about fire escapes. He rescued hundreds of orphans, many of them disabled, from terrible fires. To your right, you will see a mailbox. On many occasions, Mr. Lincoln leaned against this mailbox, usually only when he had a tummy ache. The jokes he could tell about that. And across the street here, a window. Mr. Lincoln loved windows. Unfortunately, many of his windows were torn down hundreds of years ago." Well, you guys, you can understand sarcasm. It's satire, but you can understand it because of the context in which it occurred. And she was reacting to her father's perhaps over-enthusiastic take on all the Lincoln sites and so on. And you can detect it there. And you can often detect it in the Bible as well. If you go to 1 Samuel 5 and you remember how the Ark of the Covenant was placed in Dagon's shrine, the god of the Philistines, and the next day the Philistines discovered the image of Dagon bowing down before the Ark of the Covenant, and the next day after they put him in his place, the Bible writer says. I think he was laughing hilariously when he wrote that. He's a god, but they have to put him in his place. And then the next day they go in and there's Dagon. You can only fall as a god and remain in one piece so many times. And his head and his hands were broken off before the Ark of the Covenant and so on. And he had to go to the deity repair shop. You can just see the sarcasm dripping out of 1 Samuel 5. It's there. If I had time, and you're glad that I don't, it take you to Judges chapters 14 to 16, and I think I could prove to you beyond reasonable doubt that there's a thread through all three of those chapters, Judges 14 to 16, that has the theme of the stupidity of the Philistines. Everything they do in those chapters turns to crud, you might say. Doesn't turn out right. It's the stupidity of Philistines. It's mocking the Philistines. And you can see this in some biblical narratives. But is this description here in 2 Samuel 10, 3 to 6, is this perhaps dripping with sarcasm? Can you think of the writer writing verse 4? "Hanan took hold of David's servants, shaved off half their beards and cut off their garments in the middle all the way up to the buttocks and sent them off, putting down his pen as it were and turning to you and saying, 'How do you spell asinine?'" Have you ever wondered what dumb and dumber looks like? It could well be. The writer may be mocking Ammonite stupidity here, and therefore we should learn something from it, like the urgent need we always have for wisdom. Now, we don't know all that may be behind this. It may be that they felt at liberty to treat David's messengers and consolers this way because they wanted war with Israel anyway. It could be that they wanted to gain control of the king's highway, which was the trading highway, the caravan highway that went from Damascus, it's east of the Jordan River, from Damascus down east of the Jordan River and so on, and all the way down to Eilat. And if you had control of that, of course, you could collect caravan fees. It was kind of lucrative. And it may be that they wanted to wrest control of that, maybe if Israel was in control of that, and they knew that Aram or Syria would be willing to assist them with it. So there may be thinking like that behind this and so on. But all we have is this this gross, if you want to start a war, if you want to revolt, etc., you can do it in other ways than something like this, this kind of offense that they committed. In other words, it's as if the writer is depicting the Ammonites saying, let's sit in the electric chair and see if the switch works. It's beyond stupid. Now, we don't want to laugh too hard, though, because you remember that God's people have their own problems with folly. You remember how Israel did in Joshua chapter 9, and the Gibeonites came and they wanted to make a treaty with Israel, and Israel wasn't allowed to make treaties with people who were near them in the land, but the Gibeonites made out that they were from far away, and so on, and everything looked like it was that way. And Israel was, Joshua and Israel asked all the right questions. They were skeptical at just the right points. They were very careful, but everything looked so authentic. Their water skins were cracked and broken. Their bread was nothing but hard croutons, and their sandals had holes in them patched with newspapers and so on, I suppose, and all of that. It looked so authentic. And so in Joshua 9, verse 14, we read that they made a treaty with them, and they did not ask the mouth of Yahweh, literally. Their own folly. They were fooled because they didn't seek wisdom from Yahweh. And we have the same need then as a Christian, don't we? The urgent need we have for wisdom. That's why James says in James 1, we've been over this before, James 1 verse 5, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of the giving God, who gives to all generously and without criticizing, and it shall be given him. Why did he say that? Well, because right before that he has said, count it all joy, my brothers, when you fall into multicolored trials, knowing that the testing of your faith works endurance. But let endurance have its complete work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask the giving God. Why did he say that in James 1:5? If any of you lack wisdom, well, it's connected with what precedes it. Here you may be facing multicolored trials, and you don't know exactly how to weather your way through them. There are dilemmas in those trials, and you don't know how to negotiate them. You may lack wisdom, so if you do, ask the giving God. It seems to me that that may be an extended application just from this, that this text shows us the urgent need we always have for wisdom. You don't have to be Ammonite imbeciles. You can be Christian disciples and have a desperate need for wisdom from heaven. Now, thirdly, notice that there you see here that you may hear good theology from unexpected sources. Verses 7 to 14. You may hear good theology from unexpected sources. Now, notice that David sends Joab and all the warriors to face the Ammonites and so on. And Joab gets into a jam because he goes and he confronts Rabbah, the capital city. But apparently the Aramean mercenaries were already there or in the surrounding country. So as Joab and his troops go to confront Ammon and so on, the Aramean mercenaries and so on come in behind him. And Joab is caught in a pincers movement. He's going to have to carry out a two-front war. So he makes the arrangement with Abishai, his brother. He says, I'll take some troops, I'll face Aram, and you take yours and you face the Ammonites in the city and so on. And if you need help, I'll come to your help. And if I need help, you come to me. He doesn't say, what if we both need help? He just left that out. But then he says in verse 12, and this is really the only clear theological declaration in the chapter, be strong and let us fortify ourselves for our people and for the cities of our God and Yahweh will do what he thinks right. Literally, what is good in his eyes. Now, there's a problem. Yahweh will do what he thinks right. There's a problem you may feel with that because Job says it. And you think about the source of it. You've run into Job already in 2 Samuel 2 and 3, whether you remember that or not. But this bloodletting, self-serving, hard-bitten, devious rascal called Job is speaking theology here in the last of verse 12, and you somehow wonder how somebody like that, whether they can be trusted with as a source of truth. Well, Mark chapter 1 tells us that even the demons can speak the truth about Jesus, so we shouldn't be too upset about Job doing and speaking the truth, perhaps. We should notice the sense of the text here. Some of your translations read this as a exhortation or wish, may Yahweh do what he thinks right. I've translated it as a declaration, as a conviction. And Yahweh, the subject is emphatic there in the Hebrew. And Yahweh will do what he thinks right. That seems to me that the translations that take it as a declaration rather than a wish are correct. Because with the emphatic subject goes better with a declaration or a conviction rather than a mere wish. So, I would not follow, for instance, the ESV here, but the New International Version, for instance, I think is on the right track. So it's a declaration, it's a statement, it's a conviction. Yahweh will do what he thinks right. Now, is this theology inadequate? I mean, in a way you might say this is disappointing. Here they are facing this, and the best Job can do is say, Yahweh will do what he thinks right. Can't he get any more certain and precise about it? Well, he doesn't know how things will turn out. And some of us may not be satisfied with that. We wish Job had stronger faith and more firm assurance and so on of victory here. But we have to say some things in defense of Job. How can he say more than this? Job doesn't know how it will turn out. That rests, as he states, on Yahweh. Now, there's an inference I think we can draw here. There's a sense in which faith sits loose and doesn't play God in regard to circumstances. You see, this is telling us that faith is not the same as being cocksure. Faith is resting only in what Yahweh has promised, but sometimes there is no specific promise from God. And so in cases like that, faith rests not on God's promise, but on God's pleasure. Yahweh will do what he thinks right. Okay. Now, what's the position then? Well, I said that there was no specific promise here from God about this. Now, you have, sometimes God gave his servants specific promises. You can look at Joshua 11, verse 6, for instance. Joshua was facing a northern coalition of Canaanites, and Yahweh said to him, tomorrow I will give all of them into your hands slain. He had a specific promise of victory the next day, and that goaded Joshua to go into action and attack. He had a specific promise. But here, You don't have that. God had given David assurances now in chapter 7 in the covenant passage. He'd given David assurances that he had cut off David's enemies and that he would give David rest from all his enemies. He had those general assurances and promises, but he didn't have, and Job didn't have, a specific promise for this circumstance, for this battle and conflict with the Ammonites. Generally, Yahweh will give David rest from his enemies, but it doesn't mean that he will necessarily be victorious in this particular Ammonite conflict, in this particular encounter. Now, I don't usually try to do extensive quotes of people, but let me read a quote from Calvin in his exposition on this section. Here's what Calvin said: but Job, he did not know whether God would like to humble him for a time, and if he would like him to be defeated by his enemies, to lose instead of winning. Perish the thought, injection there. Calvin goes on. He could not be certain about that, for he had no special promise about it. That's Calvin. He goes on. We see, therefore, that Job's uncertainty was not lack of faith, for we can certainly doubt, although we embrace the promises of God and hold them as absolutely certain and infallible. What we doubt, Calvin says, are the things that are not clear to us. So Calvin's saying he had no specific promise about this Ammonite conflict. And so he didn't know how it would turn out. Yahweh will do what he thinks right. Let's see if we can pull this into an application for our own circumstances. So, how do we look at this? Well, God has given us assurances, hasn't he? He's given us promises, not always specific promises, but he's given us assurances. For instance, Hebrews 13:5, I will never leave you nor forsake you. That's an Old Testament promise that is applied to a New Testament congregation there. I will never leave you nor forsake you. Well, we go to Romans chapter 8, 35 and 37, don't we? Who will separate us from the love of Christ? Affliction? Distress? Persecution? Famine? Nakedness? Danger? Sword? No, in all these things we're super conquerors through him who loved us. What can separate us? Now, who can separate us from the love of Christ? Nothing. You have that assurance, Romans 8:35. So he's given us these assurances. But God has not promised specific matters. Now, I think this is painful because there's no way you can avoid it, because this picks up where many of us are or have been. But you see, God's given you Hebrews 13:5, he's given you Romans 8:35, etc. But he has not promised, you shall not die from this surgery. He has not promised, you will never have a child taken from you in death. He has not promised, your spouse will never turn away from you and leave you. He has not promised, you will never be injured in an auto accident. There are many things in which we don't have specific promises. So what should our attitude be? You have to go back to Job's attitude. Yahweh will do what he thinks right. And you rest there. Let me try to pick up the attitude. I've told you before about that Presbyterian missionary in the 20th century by the name of Don McClure, served in Ethiopia and the Sudan and so on. There was one occasion when one of the Anuak believers there in the Sudan came to McClure seeking medical attention for his son. His son had been fishing in a river and he had been bitten by a very poisonous puff adder. McClure says that the man father was very calm as he brought his son. In fact, McClure even decided to tease him a little bit. He said, why didn't you slaughter a sheep and pour its blood over your son like you would have done 3 years ago when he was a pagan? And the fellow raised his hands in horror and said, that was in other days. Now we only believe in the blood of Jesus. But this man came calmly bringing his son, and he said to McClure, if the medicine does not help him, our prayers will. And if he dies, our lives are in God's hands. Translation, Yahweh will do what he thinks right. It's not a stance of deficient faith, but it's a stance of the only faith that you can have when you don't have a specific promise covering that precise situation. You see what this tells you? Faith does not mean that we have no uncertainties. But faith is cheerfully leaving our uncertainties in the hands of God. Faith is saying with crusty, nasty old Job, and Yahweh will do what he thinks right.
Help us, our Father, to be clear about faith and non-faith. Help us to understand that often it's not that we have a lack of faith, but that we have a lack of light. Teach us that faith can be full of uncertainties and still clinging steadfastly to you. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.